And welcome to the Department of Metal Antiquities,
where we remember what everyone else has forgotten.
As always, it is Nick Cameron, also of Glacier Musical, and I am joined by my good friend, our very own Dung King himself, Duncan Evans from Leeds United Kingdom. How are we doing today, buddy?
Hello, I like that intro there.
It's funny because you don't get it.
Okay, well, I did get it, but...
Oh, you did?
Well, I don't know. I probably didn't get it on as many levels as you're about to explain.
Okay. You're familiar with the Super Bowl, which was last weekend, and the thing about the Super Bowl, for people like me who are not big fans of the league, it's about watching the commercials, because the advertisers go all out on their commercials every year. And there was a commercial for Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah, we have them.
It featured Ben Affleck, Matt Damon, Tom Brady of the New England, formerly of the New England Patriots, Jennifer Lopez, Fat Joe. And the whole thing was how Ben Affleck, Jennifer Lopez's current husband, wanted to be a pop star as well. And so the pop group he came up with was the Dung Kings.
I see. There you go. So I did not get it on as many levels. I just got it on a very surface level, but it still worked. So
might call you that every week because I feel like it works, especially for what we're doing here. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. As you know, if you are here before, we are the podcast that teaches you about your albums you've never heard of by your absolute favorite artists. This week, we are doing some content by what band, Duncan?
Well, this is very connected to Iron Maiden, who nobody's ever heard of course.
I don't think I have about 30 of their records sitting there on the shelf. I don't think they've really done a whole lot. So let's just quickly discuss who Iron Maiden is, and I'll leave that up to you.
Okay, well, Iron Maiden are one of the most famous metal bands on the planet. They formed in London, UK, in, I believe, the late 70s. And
75.
There you go. So it formed in the mid-70s. Anyway, everyone knows really what Iron Maiden are all about, I would assume. But they went through a few different lineup changes with various different singers. And they have now got three guitar players, Adrian Smith, Dave Murray, and what's the other guy called?
Yannick. Yeah. Yannick.
There you go. So one of those three is featured on today's record, Nick. So who's that?
Featured on the record would be Adrian Smith. He also does vocals on this album, and longtime Iron Maiden fans that have not given up on the band may recall on several live albums and tours in the past decade or 15 years or so after the reunion, Adrian has also sung a verse of Wasted Years with Bruce Dickinson, famously the two members of the band who broke up the classic lineup. The classic lineup of Iron Maiden, of course, being Bruce Dickinson on vocals, Dave Smith on lead guitar, who features into the story in a moment.
Hang on, Adrian Smith.
I always get that mixed up. Because it's there's a Dave Murray who's a weatherman here, so I always assume that it can't be the same name. My fault. So, of course, Dave Murray on lead guitar, Adrian Smith on lead guitar, creating the twin gun guitar sound, the band that I would say popularized the double lead guitar player. I think they just were more popular than Judas Priest, which makes them the one that popularized it.
Sure, that was
my opinion. And then, of course, Nicol McBrain on drums, who came in on the Peace of Mind album, and the man, the myth, the legend, Steve MF and Harris on the bass guitar.
Absolutely.
This band, actually, that we are discussing today, Urchin, they released no albums until 2004, I believe the first one was. And
that sounds right, but they were not recorded at that point. These were albums that were recorded in the late 70s and early 80s, we think.
Not even 80s, just 78 to 80, basically. But what's interesting about this band is I always knew that Dave Murray was the one that got Adrian Smith into Iron Maiden.
Absolutely, I knew that.
I did not know how.
Yeah, well, they actually played together in this band originally because they were childhood friends.
Correct, they were childhood friends. The band was originally started under the name...
Evil Ways.
Evil Way. Wow, that is terrible.
It's fairly terrible. I think I've heard worse, but yeah...
It's very obvious these guys were definitely smoking pot and listening to Volume 4 by Black Sabbath.
Very probably. I don't know if Urchin's a massively better name, but we'll come on to how that came about in a minute.
I'm glad you know, because I do not. So Dave Murray joins the band eventually, or Dave Murray, excuse me, Dave Murray and Adrian Smith form the band. Dave leaves because he wants to join a proper band. And this is not a proper band at this point. And he goes in to join Iron Maiden. And then after an argument, he actually walks out on Iron Maiden because Steve Harris is, especially at this time, very famously hard to get on with and hard to work with.
Sure.
So he does come in and he records a single, I believe it is. He records, I want to say, it's Black Leather Fantasy with the B-side Rock and Roll Woman with Urchin. And I bring those up to let you know we will not be discussing those tracks today.
Absolutely. Now, it's quite hard to get much information about the background of this band. There is a Wikipedia page, but it gives you a lot about lineup changes, but it's quite hard to make full sense of this. Yes, but I'll tell you about how they got their name, which is in August 1976, once Evil Ways have been playing at around London in a lot of the big venues, they were signed by Nomis Morgan, which was owned by Simon Napier Bell, who's a pretty famous name, record producer, manager, author, journalist.
His name has come up more than once on this podcast.
It has, and he or they changed the band's name to Urchin and got them a record deal with DJM Records, who I've never heard of before, but that helped.
Prestigious label, I assume.
A British independent record label set up in the 60s, it says. So they'd obviously been going for quite a while, but stopped in 86, and worked with Pye Records as distributor.
Pie Face Records?
No, Pye Records,
Pie Face
PYE.
Records.
Is that what you call them?
No, I'm making a Mighty Boosh reference.
Oh, I can't even remember.
Every time they were auditioning for a record label, and every time they mentioned a record label, it was always Pie Face Records.
It's been a while. Been a while since I've watched it. So there you go. You can keep me educated. Keep me in the loop with that. So that's what happened, and that gave them a bit of a chance, and they released, just as you say, a couple of singles and then nothing else, and then they folded in 1980.
Yet, three whole albums were released later.
Yeah, and it's all a bit strange how this actually happened. So when you look on YouTube, the album that we're looking at today, which is called High Roller, which looks to be the second out of three albums that they originally recorded.
Yeah, my apologies. I thought we were doing the first one.
That's okay. No, it's totally fine. So this one is listed on YouTube as being from 1980. So I guess it was recorded or scheduled for original release in 1980. But it's just such a strange thing that three entire albums have been released, sorry, had been recorded and shelved in the late 70s, going into 1980, and then the band just folded before any of them were released.
That is absolutely nuts. But, one of the things I wanted to talk about today is look, one of the things on recently in on the Glacier Musical podcast we mentioned was how it seems like there's always a band where, or I guess I should say there are hundreds of millions of thousands of bands out there where one person leaves the group right before they hit superstardom. Whether they're fired, whether they leave, whatever. The most famous, of course, would be Pete Best, drummer for the Beatles. I would also mention Ron McGovney or Dave Mus Ron McGovney and Dave Mustaine, both of Metallica, when the demo that was released that got Metallica signed featured those two players, and they did not record anything. Not, they recorded nothing of serious consequence, I guess I should say. Of course, Ron McGovney was on the No Life to Leather and No Life to Leather 2, and he was on Hit the Lights on the Metal Massacre soundtrack. Dave Mustaine was on two of the on those things as well, but they were both fired and kicked out of the band before they recorded Kill 'Em All En Route to Stardom. Then you have Poison, who their guitar player decided he was going to leave and go back to Indiana while they were gigging around in LA. He decided he just couldn't do it, so he left. And then you have all of these bands. But one of the things we don't ever really talk about is the kind of person like Adrian Smith, who is in all these bands, and he is so far above all of these bands, who ends up being called up to one of these bands. So
Absolutely.
Iron Maiden's first record, the lineup was Paul Di'Anno on vocals, Steve Harris on bass, Clive Burr on drums. Oh my God, I believe. Actually, let me check that real quick, because they went through a lot of.
Different changes. I feel like it was Clive Burr on drums, but we can check that.
I am checking that right now. So at least Clive Burr on drums, and there was it Dave Murray on guitar, and then of course you had Dennis Stratton on guitar as
Absolutely.
well. And
Yeah.
Dennis Stratton, nobody, yeah, it was Clive Burr, so I was right. Nobody talks about Dennis Stratton because he was only on that first Iron Maiden album, and frankly, the first two Iron Maiden albums are kind of remembered just as well as the two Blaze Bayley Iron Maiden albums. So
I don't know, man. I think they've got a bit of a higher status than that,
I
maybe.
know I'm being flippant.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yes, there are some songs on there that became abject classics that are still in the set list today. And although there's a couple of Blaze Bayley tunes that are still in the set list today, so
Very true. Very
good on
true.
him. But after the tour, they got rid of Dennis, and that's when Dave Murray says, "Hey, I know a guy. I know a guy that could come in and play guitar." And oddly enough, he probably could have replaced Paul Di'Anno at that same point because he sings on this record. And 99 times out of 100, when a lead guitar player becomes the vocalist in his band, he sounds like a guitar player singing. And I don't know if anybody can. If anybody really understands that, but if you don't understand that, go listen to I Walk Alone from previous podcast subject Kiss Carnival of Souls, and you hear Bruce Kulick's trying to sing. And yes, it sounds like he's not a singer. However, Adrian is a singer and he sings quite well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, this is it. So this is where we're at. And yeah, like I say, I feel like I'm scrambling to find something else to say about this.
Yeah, definitely. I want to give some good information on this, but there's really almost nothing. This is a band that existed. Apparently, they recorded round about let's see, 8, 16, 26 songs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know what happened. We just don't really have that information. What we do know is that here it says at least that punk rock led to the loss of their recording contract, and meant that their gigs were drying up and the whole hard rock thing was seemingly no longer fashionable. Although, of course, the Nawabum, the new wave of British heavy metal, was also coming in at that point around 1980. So I don't know, man. It's a strange one where, someone like Adrian Smith goes off from a band which has been labeled as a has-been because of punk rock, and then joins a band which is really not very punk rock, Iron Maiden. But I suppose they just about had enough punk rock credibility and kudos with Paul Di'Anno as singer, and with the whole studded wristbands image and things like that, and the leather jackets. I guess they just about somehow managed to work within the punk era, did a band like Iron Maiden, whereas perhaps Urchin couldn't have done.
No,
Maybe.
Urchin, let's see, and we'll get more into this in the track by track, but I think Urchin had a second issue dealing with punk rock.
Well, yeah, we need to we'll get on to that. Absolutely.
They weren't just like a hard rock band. They were closer to prog, and they hit this weird Venn diagram of prog, yacht rock, and metal all at one time.
Well, and even more than that, which we'll come on to in a little bit,
It's
but
interesting to note that this album was only released in Germany in 2010.
is that right? It's just a German issue only, right? Wow.
There are, let's see, there is one, two, three, there are four, five different versions of this if you count the test pressing on listed on Discogs, and all in Germany.
Right.
That's it.
There you go. There you go.
How does that make any sense?
And this was, I believe, the record label was called High Roller Records. So this was a record label set up specifically to reissue these albums. Yeah. So the first one, Urchin, self-titled, released in 2004. Then High Roller, this one, 2010, and then Get Up and Get Out in 2012. And then there are some unofficial live albums as well, which I don't know when they were actually released. It's entirely possible that they were released back at the time. There's one from 1980 and one from 1979.
Actually, High Roller is, oh wait, no. It's the only official album release. Like the first one, Urchin is called a the Urchin and Get Up and Get Out are both called compilations.
Ah, that's interesting. So they've cobbled together different studio recordings to create an album, I suppose.
Yeah, and it, but it's the only one that's referred to as on Discogs as an album, not a compilation.
There
So
you go. Because I guess they were. So, for example, on Urchin, you've got those two singles, I believe, and then some other tracks, and then one live track. So perhaps it wasn't originally planned to be an album, and they'd just done a bunch of recording. Perhaps it's even demos, a lot of it.
I'm sure basically it was all demos, but I will say on High Roller, if those are, and I don't think High Roller was demos. I think High Roller was probably what they were going to release as an album, because
Yeah.
it sounds really good. But unfortunately, we have no information on the recording of this. We don't know where it was recorded, we don't know when it was recorded, and we don't know who recorded the damn thing. We just know that it's now on, as of 2010, you can hear it. So
Exactly.
you want to talk about a lost record. I mean, we're always looking for the lost heavy metal records by super big time people. It's a great juxtaposition. We are looking for the most obscure by the most famous. And I
Exactly.
think we might have found it this week.
Indeed, indeed. And I think this was when they had a five-piece lineup: Adrian Smith, Andy Barnett, second guitar, Richard Young on keyboards, Alan Levitt and bass guitar, and Barry Tyler on drums. That seems to match up with what we're hearing. We get a lot of twin guitar, we get a lot of keyboards, maybe not keyboards on every track, but we can talk about that in a minute. And of course, the bass and drums. So yes, and that ties in with this being recorded just around 1980 or possibly 79.
There is another band called Berlin that the bass player was in,
I've heard of Berlin.
whose records were also released on High Roller Records.
Okay, there you go.
This is getting weirder and weirder.
It is indeed. It is indeed. Yes. Well, I feel like, given the lack of additional information, maybe we need to get into the track by track and unpick this and see what is inside this record and how it all sounds.
I would agree. Let's, but just keep it calm, 'cause we gotta keep it mellow.
Okay, well, keep it mellow. So this starts with steady to fast rock and roll grooves. It's a bit Humble Pie, it's a bit Faces, but the guitars are harder than that. So already we've got this juxtaposition of slightly metally guitars with a style that's more rooted in the 70s before that metal thing was a thing. Adrian Smith's got a great laid-back rock voice. Better than I thought it would be, I have to say. Bit gruff, a bit Rory Gallagher, very bluesy. Now, this is nothing new at all, but it is done well. It's got a great chorus hook. And when it gets into the solo, you can tell that it's Adrian Smith. So, unless I'm very mistaken, Adrian Smith seems to be in the left speaker, and the other guy whose name I've forgotten appears to be in the right
Andy
speaker.
Barnett.
There you go. Because I could just recognize those Adrian Smith isms in the guitar solo. It's a bit samey dynamic-wise, although I don't think the mastering helps with that. With this being released in 2010, I'm guessing they did a bit of a mastering job on it, and I think they brick-walled it a little bit. It starts to go on a bit too much as well, and it's only 4.5 minutes or something like that, but I'm thinking, nah, I've kind of had enough of this. There's a second solo with a flanger on, and they push the dynamics a bit more on this bit, and that lifts it, so I'm back on board again. And then right at the end, it picks up, and we do get a bit of Iron Maiden. We get that galloping beat. We even get some double kick going on. But this is part of the problem. Like, you wouldn't get that galloping heavy metal Nwabum sound and the double kick drums in a Humble Pie or Faces track. And suddenly you've got that going on. So it seems like one of the, we've done so many records like this where they're in between. Where they're looking back to, let's say, in this case, the 70s, the mid 70s, maybe early to mid 70s, And they're also perhaps just on the cusp of something new, which is 80s metal. And they just haven't quite worked out where they sit in that. And already from track one, you can feel those different forces pulling against each other. So it's not, there's some great stuff in here. It's not quite all hanging together for me.
That is a lovely and perfect description. I was trying to say perfection, and anyway, yeah, it's consider like one speaker to be, 70s English blues, Humble Pie, early Led Zeppelin, Free, and then consider the right side of the right speaker to be Nawabum, where you now are into Iron Maiden, Def Leppard territory, Tigers of Pantang. And they're trying to ask each other out for a dance, and it just doesn't quite get there.
Absolutely.
It's enjoyable, and this song was about 70% old-timey, out of date, out of touch kind of music. However, had they really tapped into that 30%, I don't think Dave Murray, or I don't think Adrian, I don't think Dave Murray requests that Adrian Smith join Iron Maiden, because
Yeah.
Urchin becomes something. They would have, he may have probably still would have gotten to Iron Maiden around Number of the Beast, but
Yeah.
Urchin had the sound to be part of that old kind of, that it was almost perfect Nawabum, but it wasn't. And I don't know if that's production choice, if that is the producer's choice, if that is the label's choice, or what it is, but they chose to kind of peek their head out here and there rather than take it, belly flop into the pool.
Absolutely.
They're dipping toes, not diving heads. So, but
Exactly.
all in all, you know what? You got to make your choices. Walk up and down the street. That's just life in the city.
Indeed, track two. So this starts with a galloping shuffle, the thing with harmony guitar lead riffs. And this is much more Iron Maiden. You've got those UFO style or Wishbone Ash style twin guitars. And the bass driving forwards with that as well. This time the vocals are a bit more shouty and they're a bit punky, but there's still that old-timey bluesy thing going on. So it's still a bit confused. It's not quite all hanging together, but this is probably where they get to their most Iron Maiden-esque. It's a major key riff, interestingly enough, which reminds me a bit of the earlier Iron Maiden in particular, where from memory there's a few more major key tracks on there. Tying in with punk as well. Maybe not as melodically interesting with the vocals, but there's a nice guitar solo that lifts it with some great bass joining in with that. And then we get these twin guitar harmonies doing a kind of solo together, which has been very much orchestrated. And then even more solo in, and it's perhaps a bit of overkill. It starts to feel as though the song was written around the solos, which, given that the singer is a guitar player, you can see how that would happen. But they are cool. These are good solos. And this is me who I get very tired very quickly of what I might call pointless twiddles. But these are great solos. And the way that the band work together during those solos really lifts the dynamic and helps to push the track forward. So I don't dislike this. I still think it doesn't quite hang together. I think they've written a song around the guitar solos more than anything else. But it's not a bad track. And it's really interesting if you know Iron Maiden, which, if you're listening to this, you probably do, to hear the seeds of that sort of sound right there in these twin guitar solos.
Well, Steve Harris described that when Iron Maiden first started under their original name, which was not Iron Maiden, but I don't remember what it was, they didn't have second guitar players, so he would play harmonies on the bass. And then
Right.
when they brought in two guitar players, he's still playing harmonies, and it becomes this bigger thing. And then they bring in more guitar players, and there's all these harmonies, and that's the Iron Maiden sound, which is why Adrian Smith is absolutely perfect to join Iron Maiden, which is why Dave Murray can say, "Look, I know a guy that can do this. Listen to this." And then you hear that.
Exactly.
So yes, we definitely have, even though Adrian Smith was neither a found was not a founding member of the band, he is still, super critical to their sound, and you hear him doing it with other people. He comes in, and we go, when 18 months from the day he joins, they release Number of the Beast, which I still think is their best album to date. But that's neither here nor there. But yes, you are correct. This album, and so far, these two songs have the same problem. They're a little samey, they're a little overdone, and confused. What are we doing here? What is this music? And I don't think they ever really figured out what this music was. There are times I'm listening to this and I'm just bobbing my head and having, I'm in the grocery store spending way too much money on way too little stuff, but we're buying healthier foods. We've changed our diet. We're trying to really improve this. So all the low sodium, all the natural, all the single ingredient foods, and damn, it gets expensive. I only bought one 4-pack of beer, just in case anybody's wondering. I spent $100 at the grocery store. I barely bought beer. Barely bought beer. And but that's kind of what this is they're trying to take all of these ingredients they have and put them together. They have five single ingredients. They're trying to make a feast, and it just comes off like a potluck. You know what a potluck is? Okay. I don't know if they have those in England. They're a big deal here in Midwestern America.
Well,
And
you kind of just throw everything in a pot that you've got,
no,
basically.
a potluck is a dinner where everybody brings a dish.
Yeah, I think I sort of did know that.
So you don't like at you don't like try to coordinate. Everybody just brings something. So you've got this big buffet of God only knows what. And that's kind of like what these songs are so far. These buffets of, well, I like this Nawabum and I like this blues, but I don't see how they go together. And Adrian Smith's voice is fun, it's good, but as a vocalist, he's a really great guitar player. It's he doesn't sound like a guitar player singing, but he, as you put it, he tries to base his melody lines around his solos. And at that point, just play the solos. I mean, that's way more interesting to me personally. But anyway, as Adrian's going to tell him in a couple of weeks, watch me walk away.
All right, track three. So this starts with jangling arpeggios and syncopated bass. And this is where they go prog rock. It goes into this major key prog rock fast thing. The vocals are rock and roll and laid back again. And it's like a proggy AOR pop sort of mashup. It's a bit cheesy, but this it'd be a good contender for an offbeat hit single, this actually, because it's got a super catchy chorus hook. So they were onto something with this. But I'm not sure they're onto the same thing that they were onto with the previous tracks. It's gone very much more commercial. The guitar solos bring it away from that commercialism. But
I like commerciality.
commerciality. All right, we'll go with that. And there's a nice breakdown which helps with the dynamics. And this is where I'm noticing again the mastering. It does feel a bit brick walled, even when they go bring it down a few gears, it still feels a little bit what's the word, fatiguing to listen to. But this is like a good pop song with prog rock elements and harmony lead guitars. So it's a bit all over the place. I feel if this was just a one-off song, it could work as a slightly, as I say, off slightly off the beaten track hit single if it was pushed in the right way, maybe produced a little bit differently, maybe arranged a little bit differently. So it's a really strong song, but I'm not sure how it matches with the previous ones. It's they're onto something new again, basically.
I love how you said the word, you used the word fatiguing. Yeah, this album, as much as I'm enjoying it, which I am enjoying it, I may sound like I'm, kicking it in the crotch, but it is a very hard listen. That might be due to brick walling, it might be due to just this is so much humble pie. It's like free humble pie Zeppelin, and then they go prog, and then they go Iron Maiden, and it's like I don't know what you're doing, and you're not leaving me any breadcrumbs. You're just like dealing cards. It's like I'm playing three card Monte on the street with some hustlers. Do you have Three Card Money over there?
I don't know. I don't think I've ever heard of it.
All right, it's a card game where basically you throw down, you have a queen and you throw down, you're trying to find the red queen, you throw down three cards. The queen is one of those cards. But they do it
Okay.
so fast because they're hustlers scamming you. You're not going to win.
I see. Yeah, I get it. I get it. Yeah,
And
yeah.
that's just kind of how they're dealing styles that quickly on this album. And I'm just like, what are we doing here? Are we Thin Lizzy? Are we Humble Pie? Are we Iron Maiden? Are we Venom?
Yeah.
In the lyrics, lyrically speaking, so far, they're nothing. They're a complete nothing burger. They are as good as the lyrics to Blackjack. You remember Blackjack?
I do. Yeah, I remember that one.
Where basically it's ooh baby baby, yeah, something something something, walk this way.
Yes, from I hardly even noticed the lyrics, and I think that's why.
Yeah, and when you don't notice them, that's what they are. We are now going to be coming down to, excuse me, coming on to, excuse me, a little belchy. We are now coming on to the best lyrics on the record in the song Countdown.
Okay, well, this starts with slower, quieter vibes. You've got these minor key arpeggios and sparse drums, and it starts off like a sad and forlorn ballad. And it's, yeah, you're right. It seems to be about being a soldier. So again, like you said about the lyrics, I could pick up on them. I could see it had some meaning, and they seemed quite good. I didn't listen to them in great detail or read
They're
them, but
not good. I'm damning
are
with
they
faint
not good? Are they?
praise, sir.
Okay, I thought they were probably the better lyrics on this record, but perhaps not great. I don't know.
That's
So
exactly it. They're the best lyrics on the record,
there you go.
but
There
they
you go.
aren't great.
There you go. So, but then it kicks in double time with that Phantom of the Opera style riff, which is also on Pink Floyd's Echoes. Da 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 down. You've got that thing going on. And the vocals are reminding me of Ian Gillan in his lower register. And they've got some harmony doubling up of the vocals as they progress through the different verses. There's some great riffs here, but perhaps the melodies with the vocals are weaker in the verses. The chorus hook is good, though. I liked that. I thought that was strong. That lifted the track. You've got this huge orchestrated twin guitar solo, and this is what it's all about. When for this album, when they're getting it right for me is when they're doing these big orchestrated twin guitar solos. The band behind them is really swelling, really flowing with the dynamics. And you get that in spades here. And it is really cool. And it does remind you of Iron Maiden a lot. And they've got that visceral energy with the band playing behind the twin guitars. And you've got even more soloing from Adrian Smith, perhaps a little too much, but no, to be honest, no, it's working for me. It's working.
Never too much Adrian Smith soloing for
There
me.
you go. Maybe a bit later on there might be, but yeah, at this point, no, it's
Not
good.
for
It's
Nick.
working. Yeah. So perhaps the verses let this one down. I just thought the melodies were a little bit weaker with the vocal melodies in the verses, but it's got a great feel towards the end. Again, we've got the galloping drums, we've got the double kick, and it kind of works here. So this song hangs together better stylistically. You've got those amazing Iron Maiden-esque solos. It's just the verse is perhaps a bit weak for me.
On this particular track, when it works, it is amazing. When it doesn't work, it's a slog. And that's kind of a running theme for this album. Lyrically, they are not the best. To quote my man Spizzy Spose, they don't have anything to say. And that's fine. You know what? I listen to a lot of bands that don't have anything to say. AC/DC doesn't have anything to say. They haven't had anything to say since 1979. They keep singing. Fine. Great. Kiss has never had anything to say. It's awesome. Great. Led Zeppelin? Man, I don't know if they ever had anything to say. Really? Did Led Zeppelin have anything to say? Probably not.
Little bit, but probably not really, no.
I liked it when they did like Lord of the Rings references because it's just it not because I love Lord of the Rings, even though I watched Hobbit last night. I bought my wife for our dateiversary the Hobbit extended cut. My God, do you want to talk about just self-flagellation? As I'm just buying her these extended cuts of these things that I don't like, and then I watch them with her. So apparently, I don't know if I hate myself or love her. It's one of those two things, probably that second one. But That's kind of this. That's kind of like these songs. These songs are the extended cuts of the songs, and they shouldn't be. You add this prog, this yachty, poppy, almost commercial kind of stuff to what could be a pretty damn good metal record. And we never get that metal record, really. We never get a full, I'm going to spill my hand a little bit here, a little spoiler alert. We don't get a single metal song on this album. We get metal passages on this album. This is, how many, as you alluded to earlier, how many records have we done from the 70s where the producer, the label, the manager is trying to convince the artist, like Judas Priest, don't do this Black Sabbath metal thing. Just, play your normal rock and you're going to be a success. And then we get things like Rock-A-Rolla or, oh God, what was, there was another one that I just can't remember. There, how many of the, I mean, how many albums have we done where we said, if this is recorded 6 months later, it's a great metal record rather than whatever you crapped out. And that's kind of what this is there, it's, this is the most not surey, un, you know, this is the least sure-footed album we've ever done in terms of what
Wow,
genre of music they're playing.
that's a bold statement, but it's certainly up there. Yeah, certainly up there.
You know what? Here, if we ever find anything that's different, it will hopefully be within my own lifetime.
Lifetime track five. So this is a fast, it starts with at least a fast, big, major key, syncopated hard rock riff with bass stabs. And this is where I started to notice the keyboards. I don't think we've had many keyboards, if any, leading up to this point, but you've got the Hammond organ adding some color here. This one was weird to listen to. There was something really strange going on with the stereo image. It felt really uneven and it was quite distracting. And I don't know if this was originally a demo and they've just tried to polish it up a bit to get it on the record or what, but it's really distracting the way the production and the mix was. But anyway, this one wasn't blowing me away. It had a pretty cool bridge riff, but I think the production was distracting me a lot and nothing was jumping out. Lots of twin guitar licks, but it's bordering for me into cheese territory here. I'm just not enjoying them on this track for whatever reason. It just about gets saved when these cool lead melodies start to come in, and I'm thinking, okay, this is starting to work a bit better. And the chorus hook is not bad at all, but it's a little bit cheesy and it's been done a million times. It's a bit trite. So this is when, I didn't like this track very much, basically, and I found the production and the mix really off-putting.
Yeah, I can completely agree with everything you just said there. This song is not, I mean, to be clear, there is not a bad song on this record. There's also not a great song on this record. And when it works, it works, but it works for a short time. When it, oh, I take that back. It always works. Everything they play always works because the entire band changes their modus operandi as they go. However, having the verse work and the chorus work, but not work together doesn't work. And I think that's basically the entire, I think that's what I can say about this entire record is everything works, but it doesn't always work together. And you know what? No respect to Richard Young, but I never noticed any of his keyboards.
Right. Yeah, I
Not
didn't
even,
know
I didn't
that.
know there was a keyboard until you mentioned him. That's probably not good. Anyway, moving on to The Late Show.
All right, so the late show. This is where it gets really strange. Okay, so it starts off with a drum intro into a slow half-time shuffle minor key groove with the twin lead. And then you start to think, okay, it's kicking up a gear and it's going into like funky Deep Purple doing a ballad, which is already stretching.
We're going into funky Deep Purple, so we're in Deep Purple Mark III.
Mark four, I think,
Mark
even.
IV?
I would say we're in Deep Purple Mark four. We've got
Oh.
Thingy on guitar. What's he called? I can't remember. Tommy Bolin on
Tommy
guitar, I think.
Bolin, yeah. That's a weird Deep Purple to rip off.
Yeah, and then they're doing a ballad, and then the keyboard's bordering into reggae, and then it just gets more and more confused as it builds up, and we start to have a whole lot of Steely Dan. It's like whoever wrote this song had been listening to loads and loads of Steely Dan for the month or so leading up to writing this song. And I believe
that is the first Steely Dan reference on the Department of Metal Antiquities.
Right. Well, there you go. And I just couldn't work out, is this Steely Dan? Is this Deep Purple or is it Iron Maiden? And they start to, as they move on, lean more and more heavily into the Steely Dan feel. And it doesn't work. I think what you just talked about, where generally speaking, the chorus works on its own, the verse works on its own, but there's some, and then the solo works on its own, but they don't all work with each other. That's generally true. This track, I think, doesn't really work at all, because you've got the hard rock guitars playing along with what is mostly a Steely Dan thing. And perhaps it's exacerbated just because it doesn't fit so much with the other material, or in my view, it doesn't. But it's like this song demands smoothness. It demands that really slick, clean guitar. But they've got their Marshalls cranked up to 11, you know? And then you've got an electric piano solo, and it's really nice if it was Steely Dan. But we're really leaning into that way too much. Then you've got a guitar solo with way too much distortion for this sort of song. It feels forced. It feels disorganized. It's just not working for me at all. There are some nice twin lead guitar parts, but this is just sitting really strangely. The chorus, you know what? The chorus does work, but the arrangement is odd. Doesn't fit the arrangement and doesn't fit the style that this band have been. I mean, I know we've talked about what on earth style are they, but we've talked about three or four different styles, and then they're just going in this whole other direction that seems to have nothing really to do with any of those other styles. So yeah, this one sticks out like a sore thumb on an album where it's already a bit of a potluck, as you said. So yes, that's my view on this one. It's just strange.
This is the one, if memory serves, that has that phase kind of solo, that phaser solo. And I remember listening to that solo going, wow, this is really good. What it has to do with the rest of the song, I have no clue.
Yeah.
And if I could sum up this album better than that, I would.
Mm-hmm.
But that is my sum up of basically everything we've heard so far. Everything I have heard is great, but what does it have to do with the next thing or the previous thing?
Sure.
So anyway, I like to mention all the time, we're about to go to My Lady.
My Lady, track 7. So starts with slower arpeggios and sparse toms. Then it kicks in with the classic jazz chord sequence, the minor key one. It's also pretty much the Stairway to Heaven chord sequence, that descending jazzy sequence, which people will know. You'd recognize it if you heard it. With some lead guitar on top. Then it kicks into another sequence, and it just stays on this sequence for a long, long time. And this is an 8-minute song. The vocals are a bit lackluster here, and they're buried in the mix in favor of the guitars. So the mix is not really doing any favors for this song. And I couldn't work out where the chorus was here, because they kept saying My Lady, but I'm feeling it just still felt like a verse to me. And I think that was the chorus. And about 3 minutes in, I was thinking, this is getting really repetitive. They're sticking on this chord sequence. It's just going on and on. It's not really going anywhere. And this song is 8 minutes and however many seconds. And it just seemed to be sticking on that same groove endlessly. There are some Maiden-esque twin guitar harmonies, which lift it a little bit. But it's that same chord sequence. Then you've got more soloing from the other guy. I keep forgetting his name. Not Adrian Smith.
Andy Burnett,
there you go. And he also plays a couple of bum notes in this. Only a couple, you know, I'll forgive him. But even though the dynamics are changing underneath, it's just all going on way too long. This does not need to be an 8-minute song at all. Then they get to the next verse. I think the lady in question is supposed to have died. I'm not sure what happened there. It might be some sort of Romeo and Juliet-esque scenario. And it just goes back to that Stairway to Heaven slash jazz sequence. So it changes up the sequence at this point, but it's still too much. And there's yet more soloing. This one just, yeah, it doesn't really work for me. It's far, far, far too long. There doesn't seem to be any chorus. It's just meandering around the same groove endlessly. So sorry, not working for me.
I like that you brought up Stairway to Heaven because I feel like this was their attempt at Stairway to Heaven. It's even in the same kind of length of time. Stairway to Heaven clocks in at 7:55. This is 8:07. The difference, however, is in Led Zeppelin, you had four players that were able to impress you and excite you and write a song that will keep you interested for 8 minutes.
That's it. There's the song, the Stairway to Heaven changes and changes and changes. This one just doesn't.
No, it doesn't. And when this band works, it works. When it doesn't, they then play it for 8 minutes.
Yes.
Last track, Animals.
All right, Animals. So starts with a funky rock riff. So we're on Deep Purple Mark IV again. This is more straight to the point, but the jazzy funk thing they've got going is still strange. They're bringing back a bit of that Steely Dan-ness. The chorus hook is good. This is better for me. The vocals are a bit Rory Gallagher-esque. I think I mentioned Rory Gallagher earlier. He seemed to be leaning into his Rory Gallagher side for this
You did
track.
not, but I'm glad you did now.
Okay, there you go. So I certainly noticed that similarity in this track. But it's a this one has a good strong chorus hook, which I liked. And it's a little bit punky in a strange way, even though it's also funky. It's funky and punky. Then we've got some nice twin lead riffery going on. But again, this is stylistically confused because we're leaning into some metal territory with these twin lead riffs, but then we're going back into funk. I know funk metal is a thing and can work, but it seems that they're
It was
veering.
not a thing in 1979, however.
It was not, no. And there's lots of solo swapping at this point. They're doing the trading guitar solos. There's a nice coda which repeats the hook part of the chorus. So this song's better for me. They're ending it on a high note. It's still confused, though. It still doesn't all hang together properly for me.
I think you have completely summed up this whole record. It just doesn't quite hold together. It never really sticks. They never, they don't choose an identity. I've heard a lot of people complain about genre. Oh, genre doesn't matter, blah, blah, blah. No, it does matter. Because if you say we're a metal band or we're this or we're that, you give me a starting point to know if I like you.
Exactly.
And if you just play all genres it all the time, or you're dealing out genres like you're playing five card poker, it's confusing, and I don't know what we're doing here. I mean, are you like speed prog at this point? We've got a 3 minute song, and it has this kind of feel. So we're now in speed metal prog, except there's no metal, it's just prog. I don't know what to do with this. Well, I do know what to do with this. Frankly, this album is about it's everything works. There is not a bum note. I disagree with Duncan on that one solo. There's not a single bum note played on this record. There is not a single part of any song that is not done perfectly. However, most of it doesn't fit. So if you give me, a Prada bag to go with my Levi's jeans and my Kiss jacket, all of those things work by themselves. It doesn't mean they work together. And not one single song works all the way through. Every single song, it's like, and I think I've alluded, I meant referenced this before. There was a 1930s cartoon about a little boy who wanted to sing jazz, a little owl boy wanted to sing jazz. His father was a music teacher and hated jazz, so he made him sing, opera and classical and, the arts. And when his father wasn't around, he would sing jazz. So it'd be like he would sing these beautiful arias into bebop. Then his father back to arias. And that's what this is. It's just a complete cluster of genre. And they never have the ability to make it all work together. When you listen to Pink Floyd Echoes, when you listen to, you know, Yes or Kansas, those songs work because they found a way to make them seem seamless.
Yeah.
This never is seamless. It is always noticeable when they switch. Had they chosen any of the eight genres they threw on each track, I would be saying, spin the crap out of this. But as they've never chosen a path, they have never chosen a team. No, it's a Bennett for me, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think I have to agree with pretty much everything you've said there. I think there are some brilliant moments, especially in the guitar solos department. Sometimes it could almost be Iron Maiden with those twin guitars. But you know what? Just listen to Iron Maiden if you want that. Or if not, go to UFO, go to Wishbone Ash, go to whoever else that had been doing it before. Yeah, it's not hanging together. You're right, they're swapping and changing genres. Each section kind of works, but then the next one doesn't work with it. And there's just not enough sustained strength across this record for it to be a spin it for me. So I have to be a bin it as well. There we are.
You know what hurts? Binning an Adrian Smith record. But you know what? It is what it is. I can't. I'm only going to give you what's true. Anything else done this week, Duncan?
I don't think so. Thank you for listening.
All right, everybody, thank you for listening. Please give us some sort of interaction somewhere on the podcast. It is so helpful. Tell a friend, tell your mom, tell everyone. And with that, thank you for listening to the Department of Metal Antiquities. We listened so you don't have to.